many years ago. I had in my car one of the most pro-Israeli German politicians. At that time, he was a member of parliament, and then he left parliament. And I was asked by a German friend of mine to give this person a tour around settlements in Bethlehem. Now, to be very honest with you, I was ignorant about him. I was told he was pro-Israeli, but I didn't know how pro-Israeli he was.
Can you say his name?
Volker Beck, right? Oh, and what I remember. It was hilarious. You know, it was myself driving, himself on my side, and my friend in the back. But what I remember is that it was so clear. I mean, I took him right outside the settlement, and he saw how the settlement was being built on Palestinian land, right across a Palestinian home, what they were doing to the community there. Not a single comment. I was not even challenged. So, is Europe that weak? No, it's not. There was a research a couple of weeks ago saying that 20% of agricultural products that are imported by Europe from Israel come from settlements. I mean, you imagine if you just block this 20%, what would happen? So basically, you have very strict rules in Germany to tell me if an egg comes from is organic or not. How they call it? The free.
Bio.
Bio, bio. So then you're very strict. But when it comes to an Israeli settlement, you are not.
All right, new episode of Young and Naive. I have a new guest.
Oh, thank you. My name is Javier Abouaid, and we're meeting here in the old city of Bethlehem.
Bethlehem? I've never been.
The first time?
Yeah, first time.
Well, it's where Christians believe everything started. We're actually sitting 300 meters away from the Nativity Church.
Is it a story, or is it like factual?
Well, I believe it's factual, but it's a matter of faith, right?
All right. So you're a Christian Palestinian?
I am a Christian Palestinian, yes.
How many Palestinians are Christians and Muslims?
If you talk about Palestinians worldwide, perhaps 10% are Christians. But if you talk about Palestinians in Palestine, it's perhaps 1%.
Why so few?
Well, because even though some people don't like to talk about it, the Israeli occupation has made things impossible, and particularly in the areas where Christians live. I mean, on your way into Bethlehem, there are 22 Israeli settlements around. We have access only to 13% of the land. Even the population registry is controlled by Israel. So eventually, even imports, exports, whoever comes, whoever goes in, it's a problem. So people are very sensitive to what Israel can do here.
Were you born here? Because I see a picture of the president of Chile.
No, this is not an official building. I want to make it clear.
This is your office, right?
No, this office of a friend of mine who is the honorary consul of Chile. But this is not an official building.
All right.
I was born in Chile, like most people from Bethlehem, that were actually we had a huge community over there. It's a community that it's very particular. It started perhaps 100 years ago, 120 years ago. My family in particular left after the Nakba or the catastrophe in 1948. And many families, including mine, they kept people here, there, and they kept moving back and forth. But again, for many people, it's difficult. Actually, most of my family, they are not allowed to return here.
Because?
Because they are Palestinians, and because Israel controls the population registry. So according to Israeli law, if you are a Jew from anywhere in the world, you automatically you have the right to become an Israeli citizen and to live, for example, in one of the 22 settlements around Bethlehem. My family, deeply rooted in Bethlehem for centuries, is not allowed to come back.
Why were you allowed to come back?
Well, it's a very long story, but it was a struggle myself until I recover my ID. But when I returned here, I returned as an advisor to the Palestinian negotiations team. And it was a moment where the peace process was still working. Yet it took me perhaps 12 years to regain my ID.
12 years?
Yes, 12 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Which was it was actually very painful. And still today, you find in the occupied West Bank, thousands of people that are living here without a Palestinian ID, without an Israeli ID, without a visa, that are mainly, especially, I mean, the most vulnerable group are women married to Palestinians with Palestinian IDs, married here. They choose not to leave the country because they want to stay with the children and with the family.
Are they trapped?
they are trapped because if they leave, they will not be allowed to return. And because they are married to Palestinians, for them to gain family reunification, it's very difficult. Even in the Israeli parliament, there is a law that prevents family reunification for Palestinian citizens of Israel. So, for example, if a Palestinian from Jaffa or Nazareth, citizen of Israel, they fall in love with someone from Bethlehem, most probably they would not be allowed to have family reunification.
So you grew up in Chile?
Yes.
When? For how long?
Well,
you went to school.
I did my BA there. We used to come over summers here. Mm-hmm. But I did my high school and my BA there.
And what did you study?
My BA was political science.
Why did you study political science?
To free Palestine. That was the idea. Now, how realistic this is now after trying for a while, I don't know.
Did you ever regret your decision?
No, of course not. Of course not, because it doesn't matter the price you have to pay. At the end of the day, you know, it's a just cause. I mean, you're struggling for freedom, and that's something that I think it's a duty. You know, the Palestinian national poet Mahmoud Darwish has a quote that kept me, you know, forever in my mind. He said something like, you know, as far as Palestinians are deprived of their homeland, they are to be slaves for that homeland. But once the homeland is free, they can be free to choose whatever they want, whether they want to stay there, whether they want to leave or not. And I think we do have a responsibility to be here, to free this country. It's not just a political matter. I mean, here we're talking about our heritage, our history, our families, and the future of international law in the international system, which is what some people don't really get.
Hey Leute, politischer Journalismus muss nicht kommerziell oder öffentlich-rechtlich sein. Podcasts müssen nicht durch grässliche Werbung finanziert sein. Jung Naiv ist der beste Beweis dafür. Damit das so bleibt, unterstützt uns einfach finanziell. Danke vorab und jetzt geht's weiter.
So you studied political science and then somehow you became an advisor to a negotiation team? How did that happen?
I was here in a vacation and someone called me and said, well, we heard you're here. Would you like to have an internship with us? Mm-hmm. And I said, of course I want to.
What was that?
It was 2008. Mm-hmm. And they liked my work. So they offered me a job after I finished. I went back to Chile, finished the BA, took me another semester and I came back.
So you had a talent for this stuff?
Sorry?
You have a talent for this stuff?
I don't know. It's not up to me to say it. You should ask people that work with me. But let's say I'm very passionate on things I do.
Could you describe what the role of being, you know, an advisor eventually was? What did you do?
It's many things. Many things. It was from drafting a press release to briefing diplomats, briefing journalists. I mean, in a way, I took my job on how, with the tools I knew, to contribute to bringing justice here. That's how I took my job at that time.
Who negotiated with whom?
At that time, well, it's supposed to be still be, but now there's no negotiation of this process.
Yes.
But it's a PLO on the Palestinian side, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the government of Israel. Mm-hmm. Now, the government of Israel openly says that they don't want a Palestinian state, mm-hmm. that they don't want equality for everyone. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, Netanyahu said a few days ago that he even doesn't want to have Palestinian citizens of Israel in his government. So basically, mm-hmm. he's saying no to Palestinian independence, no to equality under one state, and not to political participation. Mm-hmm. So that's, I'm not claiming that this is much different than the time I was. I think the Israeli policies at large were the same, mm-hmm. but now it's were clearer with the statements they make.
Well, it's more honest situation now.
Of course, it's way more honest. I mean, now, you know, many people are preparing for elections in Israel, elections that will take place in October. Mm-hmm. And many people are hopeful that Netanyahu will leave. And always my question is, okay, so the alternative to Netanyahu, what's his position on the Palestinian state? Are they going to end occupation or not? And no, the answer is no. I mean, eventually what Netanyahu, Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, what they bring is honesty. Mm-hmm. Right? They are very open to what they want and where they want to get. And I think what's more problematic is the fact that It's so clear, but there is no action in return. And I remember once your foreign minister issued a statement saying that he spoke with his Israeli counterpart and was very clear that they cannot build the E1 settlement that will split the West Bank into two. Mm-hmm. And he was very clear. I don't know if the day after, two days after, the Israelis announced that they were doing biddings for the E1 settlement, yeah. Right? So, and that happens, and then what?
I mean, so it's just words.
It's just words. I mean, you know, when the Gaza genocide started, I was being interviewed, and I said, you know, the world will have two options here. So you either protect the rules-based international system, and you intervene against whoever is to blame. I mean, this is not about being pro-Israel, pro-Palestine, or anything. Or you destroy this international rules-based system by granting impunity for those crimes. And then almost 3 years later, you know, over 70,000 people killed, 70% of Gaza destroyed, and they continue building settlements and the annexation policy, and everything is there. It's so clear. So what else is needed for action to take place?
Right? So what do you think?
I don't want to lose hope. That's a problem, yeah. Right? I mean, my family tells me, by the way, what did you get out of your negotiations? What did you get out of international law? Yeah. What did you get out of the UN?
What do you say?
I fully understand. Well, my answer is that it's going to be a long path, and we need to build alongside that path. I am personally someone who doesn't believe in armed struggle, for example.
Why?
Not because we don't have the right to. I mean, it's enshrined in international law. But
you are allowed to resist occupation.
Of course. Yeah. We are allowed to resist occupation. Of course, there are legitimate targets here and there. But when you're in a situation when you are condemned to be the neighbor of the other side, eventually you may want to think, that's what the Israelis are not thinking, by the way. You may want to think on how to build a future relationship, right? And this is precisely what Netanyahu, what Ben Gvir, what Smotrich, but even Lapid and others, they don't think about. I mean, if you don't start from the principle that we are all human beings entitled to the same rights, and you keep believing, oh, okay, but Palestinians, you know what they say about Gaza? No, there is no blockade in Gaza. We are allowing enough calories for them to survive. I mean, can you imagine how racist they have made just for dehumanizing Palestinians? So eventually, I don't really have an answer for people who tell me what is your international law for or what is any sort of international pressure for. But what I know is that over the past 3 years, international public opinion has significantly changed. What I know is that today, being pro-Israeli, which means at this stage being pro-occupation, it's actually a liability in international politics, that many things are changing, including in your own country, which is a huge change. Again, perhaps not in the elites, but yes, in the streets.
It's quite amazing. Like, our political class is very much still, you know, on Israel's side, but the population, like 75%, are against this kind of allyship. Like our allyship with Israel is almost as unpopular as being an ally with Russia is almost as popular as being an ally with Israel or the US.
You know, I remember many years ago, I had in my car one of the most pro-Israeli German politicians. At that time, he was a member of parliament, and then he left parliament. And I was asked by a German friend of mine to give this person a tour around settlements in Bethlehem. Now, to be very honest with you, I was ignorant about him. I was told he was pro-Israeli, but I didn't know how pro-Israeli he was.
Can you say his name?
Volker Beck, right?
Oh!
Oh! and what I remember, it was hilarious. You know, it was myself driving, himself on my side, and my friend in the back. Actually, I saw my friend in Germany a few days ago, and I told him, you remember when this happened? Well, of course I remember. But what I remember is that it was so clear. I mean, I took him right outside the settlement, and he saw how the settlement was being built on Palestinian land, right across a Palestinian home, what they were doing to the community there. Not a single comment. I was not even challenged. I don't know if it's because some people, when they see so the evidence in front of them that clear, that they perhaps they just go blind, they don't want to see, or perhaps they just know they don't care, which also may be the case. I mean,
I think so.
I'm not. Yeah, I mean,
he's very famous now for being, you know, the head of one of the largest lobby groups for Israel, the German Israeli Society.
He's the head of a group that calls for impunity for genocide, impunity for war crimes. I mean, let's say it clearly. Once again, I do believe that there was a moment where people call themselves pro-Israeli because sincerely they believe in the idea of Israel being here. You can ask me later on about what I think about it, but on the idea of Israel being here, but in the context of a peace process, two states, Israel and Palestine, I believe some people were like this, perhaps 20, 30 years ago. Yeah,
peaceful coexistence.
Peaceful coexistence. Today, being pro-Israel is just being pro-occupation, pro-war crimes, against Palestinian self-determination, pro-racism. I mean, you have 65 laws in the Israeli parliament that only discriminate against Palestinian citizens, not me, not Palestinians in the occupied territory, Palestinian citizens of Israel. And yet, you know, the Bundestag, you still see people saying, well, we share the values of democracy and human rights.
The only democracy in the Middle East.
That's what they claim. It's a very strange democracy, right? But again, things are so clear. You know, you asked me about where I was born, mm-hmm. Chile. I remember I met the judge that prosecuted Pinochet, the dictator in Chile. He came here. I met him here, not in Chile.
Okay.
Judge Guzman was his family name. He was invited, I think, by B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization. And he said something very important. It kept ringing in my mind. He said, it's true that you don't have justice now, but it's very important to document everything, which is what you are doing. Mm-hmm. Because once there is justice, everything will be there, which is what happened in Chile. Now, they had 17 years of dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And then a few other years where impunity was granted. But once there was a chance, everything came out. And when it comes to here, it's not just, you know, that you have some isolated Palestinian NGO looking for Israeli war crimes. You have Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the United Nations, including their independent experts. There is a consensus in the human rights community about what Israel is doing. Yeah. So Germany may cite an Amnesty International report to claim that in Venezuela there is no democracy. But when Amnesty International says that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid, then you condemn Amnesty International. I mean, that's where we have reached.
One more question regarding armed struggle. Are you in a minority here regarding, you know, being against the armed struggle?
No. I don't think it's about being a minority or a majority. It's about being able to provide a viable path for national liberation. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we are. Mm-hmm. So eventually, I'm not one of those who say we don't have the right. Of course, we do have the right. I mean, under international law, there is a right. But eventually, what you need is to set a viable path for the future. Now, what's the problem? And I think this is the biggest question that people like me face. Mm-hmm. We went to the International Court of Justice. We went to the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. We went to the Security Council. We went to the UNGA. Civil society called for BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And what did we get out of this, right? I mean, we have, for example, Benjamin Netanyahu is a fugitive of international justice, of the ICC. Well, your politicians make pilgrimage to come and see him here because they don't want trouble with him going to Germany, so they come here. Mm-hmm. So is it policy that the German foreign minister or the German chancellor would talk with someone who's a fugitive of international justice? And then, you know, they come out and say, well, we made clear our position, but we don't think it's time to impose sanctions, really? Mm-hmm. So when is the time? So eventually, I am struggling to believe that what people like me think and have advocated for is the right path. But people like those politicians in Germany keep making it more and more difficult for this to succeed.
then again, like Germany is like in a special situation now, or like in a minority situation in Europe. I mean, things are changing, at least on a symbolic level. Like in France has recognized the state of Palestine, Portugal. Now, a lot of more and more European countries. I think that it's only Italy now and Germany from the bigger countries are left. Does that actually actually matter? Like, you know, recognizing the state of Palestine, because there has not been a material change.
I would say that recognition is an important step, but a very basic one. Mm-hmm. Let's put it this way. I mean, you cannot just say, "Oh, yeah, you support Palestinians, they recognize," and that's mm-hmm. it. No. Right. Recognition is a very basic element. It's at the basis of everything. You really believe in a political process in the future between Israelis and Palestinians? Fine. The least you can do is to recognize a state of Palestine. But it's equally or even more important for them to take concrete measures on Israeli settlements, on Israeli settlers. I mean, how is this that Israeli settlements are being funded from Germany? How is this that the European Court of Justice comes out with a ruling saying you have to label, I'm not even ban, no, label settlement products? Mm-hmm. And in Germany, you don't want to label them. I understand there is they want to compare this with the anti-Semitic persecutions. I understand, mm-hmm. but it's not the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, someone should come out and say, "Listen, this is not the case." And by the way, many Jewish activists say it's not the case. Mm-hmm. Many Jewish activists call on Germany not even to label, but to ban those settlement products. Now, once again, if we want to get out of all this discussion, it's much better just to be clear and say, well, what do we want? Do we want a two-state solution? Then to have a two-state solution, we need to end the occupation. What do we need to do to end the occupation? Let's take this on the side. You don't want to take what's needed to end the occupation? Fine. Let's all live with equal rights under one single state. Mm-hmm. I'm not against that.
You know, against one state with the same rights for everyone?
I'm not. Of course not.
Why not?
Because that's the only moral alternative to a two-state solution with two sovereign democratic states. Mm-hmm. But so far, what Israel is trying to build is a one apartheid reality or one state and two systems. Mm-hmm. You know, even the Israeli quote-unquote progressives, you know, there is a party called the Democrats mm-hmm. in Israel. They're running for the elections. They are not willing to say Palestinian state in their platform. They are not willing to say end occupation. They say separation. You know, I told one of their advisors once we met, said, but you realize that separation without sovereignty is apartheid, right? I mean, you're basically separating from this virus, you know, myself, you know, you're sterilizing, you know, yourself from me, but they still don't have rights. And no, this will come in the future. How long should I wait to have a decent life, to have an airport, to have the right to go outside the country whenever I want and come back, to be able to plan a life, to be able to have the agriculture we want? I mean, think about this. We are bankrupt in Palestine. There is an economic crisis all over the place. I think 10 years ago, there was a report by the World Bank saying that if Palestinians had access to Area C, which is over 61% of the West Bank, only for agricultural purposes, not even for housing, we would make $2,000 million a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's more than EU support, than UN, than anything. So could Palestine be a self-sustaining country? Of course. So eventually, it would be much cheaper for countries like Germany mm-hmm. to support once and for all any occupation than to keep sustaining this system with projects and donor money and stuff that eventually we need it. I'm not saying stop giving it, mm-hmm. but it's just prolonging the situation where we are.
Back to the recognition, like the German political establishment, mm-hmm. let's be honest, they're saying, okay, we will recognize Palestine once there is, negotiated two-state solution.
No, I would say what they mean is that they will recognize Palestine when Likud recognizes Palestine. I mean, that's what I think many German politicians believe. But
Bibi's party.
Yeah, Yeah, that's what I think. Because some German politicians have this thing in their mind that whatever Israel defines as their security interest, whatever they define as their national interest, whatever, they are going to endorse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when the genocide started, my friends in Fatah Youth, they got a letter from Jesus, the youth of the SPD, mm-hmm. telling them that they were going to freeze relations with them because they didn't condemn October the 7th.
Yeah. Fatah is like part of the Social Democratic Party system.
Yeah.
Just for audience.
And I remember my friends in Fatah Youth, they responded the letter saying, no, we are totally against suspending. We're canceling relations with you. Because whenever we ask for your solidarity and your support, you're not supporting. And you're just trying to equate between occupier and occupied. Mm-hmm. Why? I don't know. They are progressives in theory, right? That's what they claim. You know, and a friend of mine actually in the letter wrote to them that when it comes to Palestine, you are no more progressive than Viktor Orban. I found it fantastic, you know, this answer. I don't think that in Germany we don't have partners. We do have, and again, it's fascinating how you hear more and more voices. But you have establishment mm-hmm. and a political elite mm-hmm. that is very well rooted in this idea that whatever Israel defines is the national interest, we should support it. I don't think they are contributing to bringing peace here.
I mean, you've mentioned the genocide in Gaza a few times. The war started after October 7th. How did you experience the day on October 7th? Did you realize that the Israeli government will take revenge and there's going to be an invasion, that it's going to be worse than the campaigns before?
Yeah, I remember October the 7th very well.
Because you were against armed struggle.
Yeah, there is a difference between being against armed struggle and not understanding armed struggle. Mm-hmm. I'm not someone who's naive, and I'm not a pacifist. I mean, just to be very clear. Yeah. But of course, I'm against attacks against civilians wherever they are. And I think as Palestinians, we should have a very clear position on this because we are being affected on a daily basis on attacks against civilians. Mm-hmm. So it's not only about October the 7th. But when I was looking at the images in the morning, the first thing that came to my mind is how many people will be killed. Mm-hmm. But I never thought it was going to be over 70,000 people. I mean, to be honest, by the end of October the 7th, when there were figures that 1,200 Israelis were killed, mm-hmm. I said we'll reach perhaps 12,000 Palestinians because that's a range somehow. You know, if you kill one Israeli, it's 1,000 Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So I thought we were going to reach that. And unfortunately, you know, every week from the first 3-4 weeks, I was right with every figure. People would ask me, what do you think will happen? I would say, well, 1,000 people will be killed. 1,000 people were killed. Because you know what's most problematic? Is that you didn't need to be an expert. It was so clear. That's why when Ursula von der Leyen, you know, and others came and said, you know, Israel has the right to defend itself. I mean, you're giving green light to a genocide. I mean, there is a difference between condemning attacks against civilians and going and giving just a carte blanche for Israel to do whatever they want. So could this genocide have been stopped from the very beginning? Of course. It was not. And I think we have a long memory and humanity will have a memory. I mean, we remember those figures that enabled the genocide from Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken in the US to several other politicians. I mean, in Germany, you had a foreign minister who justified attacking hospitals. I mean, that's something that really doesn't come to my mind. Be as pro-Israeli as you want. Mm-hmm. But really, like, are you willing to destroy the Fourth Geneva Convention for the sake of shielding Israel?
I mean, there's no justification for genocide and Israel's actions. But like, couldn't Hamas and the other militant groups who, you know, were responsible for the massacre on October 7th, couldn't they have like foreseen, you know, this you know, this this revenge by Israel, like in eventually, like in hindsight, did they do a disservice to the Palestinian people?
I think October the 7th went way beyond what they expected.
They were more successful in some way than they expected?
I don't know if they were successful or not. But I think it went way beyond what they want. And I'm telling you this also, you know, there are things that you hear here and there. Mm-hmm. Just trying to do analysis. Mm-hmm. I don't think they expected that it was going to be that easy for them.
Yes.
And there was a moment where in the morning, I think they, if I'm not mistaken, the number of people that they deployed was 1,200. Mm-hmm. They could have deployed much more, but I don't think they were expecting, you know, that things were going to go that way. Mm-hmm. I do believe that anyone that launched an operation like this, regardless mm-hmm. on whether it went the way they expected or not, should have realized what an Israeli response could be. Mm-hmm. Throughout many years of Palestinian revolution, there were several operations that were not conducted because leaders would understand what the response would be on Palestinian civilians. And I'm talking particularly when the PLO was in Lebanon, for example. Yes. There were several operations that were canceled because, you know, the assessment was this was going to provoke more harm. And I do believe that people in Gaza, I mean, it's not something I believe, it's what surveys say and what people are saying openly, and they would love to have some Hamas people accountable for what happened. But let's also remember, and that's one of the lost opportunities I think we had, mm-hmm. that when the International Criminal Court issued the arrest warrant against Netanyahu and his defense minister, they also did against Hamas people. And I think instead of trying to shield Netanyahu, they should have said, fine, we're going to implement it for everyone. Now, everyone that got the arrest warrants when Hamas was killed by Israel later on, so, I mean, there is no one to be detained now. Eventually, they could issue other warrants. But I think one of the main points that people should focus is that it's not that the international system doesn't have tools to deal with such situations. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, is that they don't want to deal with this because it's Israel.
Hier ist Tyler. Hier kommt die Werbung. Für uns selbst. Kommerzfreier Journalismus seit 2013 nur möglich durch deine Unterstützung. Schau in die Infos wie.
Let's go to today, the situation in Gaza today. Who should rule Gaza? Like if you could have the choice, like what would be the ideal scenario of, you know, if Israel plays along and the international community pressures Israel to go along, who should rule Gaza? Hamas?
No, I don't think Hamas. But I think that no ruler should be in Gaza that doesn't have, first of all, Palestinian legitimacy, and second, a mandate from the UN. Now, what we are facing now in Gaza, it's very difficult because they are setting precedents that are complicated, not just for Palestine. I mean, this board of peace that Trump created, this is an attempt to have an alternative to the UN. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it positive? No, of course it's not. Mm-hmm. Now, they are now saying, okay, so if Hamas demilitarizes, mm-hmm. we're going to allow for more humanitarian aid. So they are basically contributing to setting 2 million people in Gaza, or 1.8 million, I don't know how many people are left now, in Gaza, hijack to a political reality that they are not part of. Mm-hmm. And most people in Gaza, you know, are children. They didn't vote for Hamas in the 2006 election. Many of them were not even born when those elections took place. I believe we do have a big problem with regards to our internal system as Palestinians, and that's a fact. And I think the genocide in Gaza should be a call for those politicians to do what's needed in order to unite. And I do believe that it has to be the Palestinian national institutions that will take control of Gaza, not the Board of Peace, and certainly not Israel.
Let's look into the West Bank, East Jerusalem. Let's talk about the PLO. Do they have legitimacy these days? I mean, there hasn't been an election for many, many years. Like, is this like a democratic system?
No, I mean, I don't think that people could argue that this is a perfect democracy at all, right? Sometimes you hear slogans in the street. Do you believe, oh, wow, we are living in a democracy? No, we are not. I do believe, though, that our political culture is still very democratic. And I do believe that we have the institutions or the system that if we had regular elections, it could work. I mean, it wouldn't be difficult to make it work. Let's put it this way. But the PLO as an institution is not questioned for many reasons. And I think the most important is that it's a guardian of a Palestinian rights. It's the one that represents Palestinian rights in the United Nations, for example. So you may have many questions about those who are ruling the PLO today, but you don't want to delegitimize the PLO as an institution. Yeah. Let's put it this way. Now, we do need elections. They claim we want to have elections later this year. I hope that will be the case.
They decide if there are elections.
But in fairness, I'm not part of the political establishment today. But in fairness, the decision to have elections is first of all a Palestinian demand, and finally, you know, we have a response saying we're going to have elections in November, right? I do believe, though, that if anyone outside is interested in elections, they should now be putting pressure on Israel, not on the Palestinians. Mm. Because in order to have elections, we need candidates to be able to move between cities. Israel usually makes use of the elections to arrest candidates, for example.
Really?
Of course. There was an agreement signed by Israel that would allow for elections in occupied East Jerusalem to take place. Last time they said they were not going to allow them to happen. They should allow for elections to take place in Jerusalem. They should allow for candidates, especially if we have a presidential election, to be able to move between the West Bank and Gaza, for example. I mean, those are things that it's not like we're asking for something new. Those are obligations Israel signed on throughout the years. Now, Israel could just perfectly come out and say, listen, guys, I want to end the Oslo Accords, and that's it. And then let the world deal with them the way they prefer. But as far as they are not saying this, they are binding by those agreements they have signed. So if I were in the part of the international community that quote unquote believes in democracy and want everyone to vote, fine. But go and put pressure on them so we can have the democratic election we need.
Could you explain, like, what kind of political movements are here? Like, there's Fatah, right? And Abbas is basically the boss. Is there Hamas here? Like, are there other more progressive parties, groups?
I think the Palestinian political system is in a crisis, deep crisis. And I don't have to be an expert to say that. It's clear. Of course, Fatah remains the most important political party for many reasons. But I also believe that when you look at surveys, this is also a moment where Palestinians at large, they don't feel identified with any political party. Mm-hmm. Not Fatah, not Hamas, not... the left, I think, has been going through a very similar process to left-wing parties elsewhere, where they still are trying to find their new identity, you know, 30 years after the end of the Cold War. And this is a problem that left-wing parties have faced in many places. Mm. You know, you may find, for example, a society in Palestine that can be socially conservative, but can be very liberal politically. And that combination sometimes allows for alternatives, particularly for left-wing alternatives. But I think the most important question those parties should be asking movement is, what will be their plan for to end the occupation? I mean, I think that's at the core of things. And I think Fatah, you know, they just had a conference that left way more questions than answers.
Why?
For the way it was conducted. To be honest, I follow politics. I like politics. Mm-hmm. I wasn't very excited about those elections. I mean, think that we had
internal
elections. Right. Think that we had municipal elections. I vote in Ramallah, mm-hmm. And those elections, in theory, were going to inaugurate what they referred to as a year of democracy. Well, I couldn't vote in Ramallah. There was only one list.
Huh?
Yeah, only one list. So
who decided the list?
Fatih decided that list. But I asked people, and I went and I asked, you know, politicians, even from the opposition, like, why you didn't present yourselves? Why? There was more than one answer, but it so elections, for example, municipal elections were less competitive this year than they were 4 years ago. Now,
is it like it reminds me, like I was born in East Germany, you know, before the wall fell. Kind of sounds like that. Everything basically was, you know, set before the actual election.
I would want to believe it's not like that. Mm-hmm. I would want to believe, but I also think that we are, in the context we have here, the context of occupation we have sets a lot of the rules that we have. I mean, you know, I was invited to give a lecture in a university here, and one of the things that the professor that is with them all the time told me is that it was the first lecture they had after the war between Israel and Iran, where they could not make it to universities, and they were having online classes. Mm-hmm. And he told me how terrified the students were to express their opinions online. So he said, you know, we just spent, you know, 1 month where I couldn't teach. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you have a class of international relations or a class of political theory, I mean, you need people to be able to present their positions, mm-hmm. to exchange ideas. Our students are scared of talking online. We have hundreds of students that are detained in Israeli jails with no charges against them. You know, yeah, this morning, you know, before you came, I was having breakfast with my family, and they told me about the daughter of our neighbors. A very nice girl, 20 years old, a journalism student, a member of our national football team, mm-hmm. detained by the Israelis. They just gave her administrative detention, meaning there are no charges against her, but she will stay for 6 months in an Israeli jail. So people are, especially young people, they are scared. In many cases, and those who are not, or those who are courageous enough to come out and present their ideas, they can be faced with realities like the one of my neighbor.
Two more questions. How big is the, let's call it, corruption problem within the PLO? Like I hear, like, when I've, you know, there's a Palestinian diaspora in Europe and especially in Germany, and if they talk about their own, you know, leaders, corruption always comes up.
It is a problem. I mean, no one can deny it's a problem, and I think sometimes the issue of corruption is
how does it work?
I mean, there are different ways of corruption. I mean, there can be nepotism as corruption, mm-hmm. for example. Now, corruption is not something I like to talk about, not because it doesn't exist. It certainly does, and it's a big problem. But it's been used as a tool to deviate from the issue of the occupation, sure. which is, I think, the main aspect.
Which we talked about. Maybe.
No, of course. No. I'm not talking about yourself. I'm just saying in general.
Sure.
Like the issue of reforms, for example. Like they're saying, now we need that reform PA. So the question is, who is asking for the reforms? I mean, did anyone ask the Palestinian people which reforms we want? Mm-hmm. Or I have some expert from Germany coming to tell me, listen, you should not say in your educational curriculum that Haifa was part of Palestine, because that incites violence. I mean, really? Mm-hmm. Like, that incites violence, but the checkpoint outside my home doesn't, right? Or the Israelis entering my neighborhood every night? No, it doesn't. It doesn't incite. But you know, but if we quote history and we say before 48 Haifa was part of Palestine, mm-hmm. and Palestinians were there and were expelled in 1948 through the Nakba, mm-hmm. that incites violence. But no, again, there is a huge crisis. Why? Because on one side you have, we do have our internal problems, of course, and I mean, there is a reason why I'm no longer part of the system. Right? I made a decision to continue, mm-hmm. but there is a difference between this on one side, and then the lack of leadership in general to say, we're going to end the occupation, we're going to hold Israel accountable. since they are failing to do that, they focus on reforms and they focus on corruption and they focus on, I mean, my main problem is still the occupation. And I think that's where I would want to focus. That's why, you know, my message usually, I mean, when I meet with German officials and they talk to me about such matters, it's, you know, if you're not really willing to tackle the real issues, stay on the side. I mean, because the role of Germany, if you ask other Palestinians, they will tell you it's positive. Why? Because they're paying. So there are projects that are being funded and that helps the economy.
That's why, that's why always the corruption comes up, like, oh, what is being done with our money? We want to help the Palestinians and don't want to,
But I think the Germans and Europeans in general, they do have systems that allow them to see where their money is spent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not putting it on that side. But what I would say is, you know, some people may claim that what Germany is doing is fine, what the EU is doing is fine because they are contributing financially. But then Germany prevents any sort of collective action within the European Union. Mm-hmm. Now, Israel is Israel's main trade partner. So is Europe that weak? No, it's not. There was a research a couple of weeks ago saying that 20% of agricultural products that are imported by Europe from Israel come from settlements. Mm-hmm. I mean, you imagine if you just block this 20%, what would happen? Mm-hmm. So basically, you have very strict rules in Germany to tell me if an egg comes from is organic or not. How they call it? The free...
Bio.
Bio. Yeah. So then you're very strict.
Yes.
But when it comes from an Israeli settlement, you are not. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think those are part of the points that people should be looking if they truly believe on a political solution.
Final question. What about the role of women in politics? Like, I don't know any, I mean, I could be ignorant, but I don't know any leading Palestinian, like female politician, like all the seemingly ministers or whatever you call it below, there seem to be women. What's going on?
No, I think women in society, they have more of a very... I think the way women stand today in Palestinian society is way more advanced than it used to be. And I'm not saying, I mean, I don't like the perspective of saying, oh, women are oppressed and discriminated and left on the side. Whoever says that, they don't know Palestinian society. I mean, in our universities, almost all universities have over 50% of the students being women. So for example, access to education remains important. Now, it's true. Now, many parents, they don't want to send especially the daughters to universities. But why? Not because they don't want them to be educated, but because they are afraid of settlers attacking them on the way. And that's also a reality we have. Because Israel is now putting, there is a new law in the Israeli parliament not to allow people from Palestinian universities, Palestinian degrees, from working in Israel. So what happens with Palestinians in East Jerusalem, for example? That is part of the occupied territory, but it's under Israeli control. Again, so we have those issues. Now, I think many people miss the role of having like a strong... big figure, woman figure in Palestinian politics. We had Dr. Hanan Ashrawi for many years.
Yeah. I tried to talk to her. She was unfortunately.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She's someone many of us admire, and I think many women admire, and they want to follow her steps. But I would really invite you to go to the grassroots where you have many women that are leading there, and I'm certain that once we regain our electoral process, you are going to see more and more women that will appear. But today, the issue, it's not just about women leadership. What about youth leadership? So we have a big problem in this political system that hopefully, if elections are conducted, you are going to see a few new names.
So thanks so much for your time. This was fun and interesting. And let's do this again at some point in the future. I'm sure the occupation won't go away that fast.
Well, unfortunately, I cannot deny what you're saying, but yeah, I would love to talk with you again.
Bye.